This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. On this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best,
Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan Chase, on the economy.
People should remember the American financial system is the foundation to the global economic system. And the closer we get, more panic, we might get downgraded.
Former President Bill Clinton pushes for ditching the Electoral College.
The effect of the Electoral College is to give about 36 extra votes to the most culturally conservative American states.
And former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair says London's finance and tech industries are reeling from Brexit.
There are problems being caused by the overhang of the Brexit difficulty.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
And some of the issues in the banking industry with the regional banks continue to unfold. Of course, the fight over the debt ceiling is raging on as well, and the Fed's battle with inflation. Well, that's all up in the air as well.
And of course, Denise, JP Morgan Chase has played a central role in that banking crisis,
including being the main buyer of the assets and assumed deposits of First Republic Bank after it failed.
And our Francine Lacroix caught up with Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan Chase, on the sidelines of the bank's Global Markets Conference in Paris. Let's listen in.
Debt ceiling or banking turmoil? What are you most worried about?
Happy to be here. Well, I think the debt ceiling is potentially catastrophic.
Yeah.
So that's a whole different issue. Hopefully it won't happen. You know, the banking crisis, I still believe, will kind of sort its way through. And it's not anything like 08 or 09. Only a couple of people are offsides with all these various things, which you knew about. Yeah. So hopefully, you know, it's getting near the tail end of that.
But if you're Janet Yellen right now, what would you do differently?
I don't know. I think we need to finish the bank crisis. I think we've had uncertain policy on mergers, this First Horizon deal. I think we have to assume there'll be a little bit more. So, you know, whatever the FDIC, the OCC, the Federal Reserve, you know, whatever they need to do to make it better, they should do. Be thoughtful, be very forward-looking, you know, not be surprised constantly, because some of these things have been known about for quite a while. And so we've handled three, SVB, Signature, First Republic, and so.
But
I think it's very important. The regional banks, who I've been speaking to like every day for the last week, they're quite strong. You know, they're quite worried because of the, you know, run on deposits, like that. But their financial results are good. Their financial results are going to be good, okay, next quarter. You know, they're earning money. They've got very good clientele, very diversified. And they're quite strong.
But are you asking Jenny for like a comprehensive solution? So if you're asking Janet Yellen to get the job done, what does that look like, that solution?
I'm not asking for a comprehensive solution.
Why not?
Just be prepared for problems. We don't need a comprehensive solution.
What do we need right now? Do we need regulators to look at short sellers of banks?
Yes. You know, like, look, my folks would tell me that that's not the problem, the short selling ban. If you actually analyze stocks and short sales, doesn't seem that big a deal. I think they may partially be wrong. Because as you know, some people are unscrupulous and they use other means to go short. I think that if you look at the detail, the SEC has the enforcement capability to look at what people are doing by name in options, derivatives, short sales. And they should go, if someone's doing anything wrong, people are in collusion or people going short and then making a tweet, you know, about a bank, they should go after them. And vigorously, and they should be punished to the full extent the law allows it. So I think it's possible it's taking place. We have no evidence of it, but you know, my experience in life has been, don't assume too much.
Do you think that they're looking into it?
I hope so. I don't know.
When you look at some of the position of JP Morgan, of course, you didn't really buy any long-dated bonds. And at the time, a lot of people said, look, stop hoarding cash. Do you think regulators and investors had pushed some of these banks to take unwarranted risk?
Yes, I do, but let's be clear. The people to blame are the bank CEOs and the bank boards and things like that. Having said that, I think there's been a humility on the part of regulators that the Federal Reserve itself never forecast interest rates going up. Not one Fed governor forecast it. And whether you forecast it or not, you should be stress testing people for it. Their stress tests always had low rates. We always knew about uninsured deposits. And there were huge incentives that banks to put securities in held to maturity, lower capital requirements, huge incentives to own treasuries, lower capital requirements, and they counted for liquidity. And I'm hoping all that gets looked at, and they should look at it and say, yeah, okay, we were a little bit part of the problem, as opposed to just pointing fingers.
So this is what, not a regulation problem, it's a supervision problem.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. They become very related. I mean, supervisors look at, are you doing the right thing by regulations and so. And like even the stress test, I've always thought that, you know, when you have one stress test and you have a company completely focused on that for 3 months, you know, does it lull people to a false sense of security that all these other things aren't going to happen? And all these other things in history always happen. And so, you know, I think it was a little bit of a mistake to have one stress test. God, I'm not asking them to do many at this level of detail, but, you know, our stress test is 200,000 pages long. Do you think that last 100,000 pages added value? And my view is it did not.
Do you think but things will change because of this? Is this like a catalyst?
I think it's going to get worse for banks. I think that people...
What do you mean by worse?
It's just more regulations and more rules and more requirements. I hope they do it very thoughtfully because, you know, we love the community banks, the regional banks. We're the biggest banks of those folks. But, you know, if you overdo certain rules, requirements, regulations, you know, some of these community banks tell me they have, you know, more compliance people than loan officers. You know, and so at one point you make it harder for them to do business. There are already hundreds of rules in place. And in a lot of ways, it's the mix of the rules. If you're going to change liquidity, maybe not capital. If you're going to change capital, maybe not liquidity. If you're going to add TLAC, then maybe you should do something with deposit insurance. They should sit down and have a very thoughtful conversation about what those things are and what we want the outcome to be. And if you look at the present outcome, a lot of things are leaving banks. And they should. You know, I'm not, and if that's what they want, so be it. But that should be done with the forethought. That should not be done because you're just putting rules and regulations in place and you don't know the consequences. The mortgage business, for example, is, you know, largely, not largely, 80% out of banks today. And just be careful about what you wish for.
So you bought First Republic. You've had, I imagine, now a good look at what's inside it. What did you find out?
Yeah, no, we had a good look before we bought it.
That's reassuring, but anything that you found out?
We had 800 people working around the clock for a long time to look at something like that. And in reality, look, they did some things really well. Like, if you talk to their customers, I'm getting calls and emails, and great culture, great customers, and things like that. Right. Their credit is kind of pristine. You know, that's good. So, of course, we marked all the market, and we're all in very good shape. We've hedged all the interest rate exposure together. We've got thousands of people now going out, learning about what their best is. We want the best of both. We're not the kind of company that comes in our way or the highway. And so there's no surprise there. It had to make sense for shareholders, but, you know, this notion that it was an unbelievable thing, no, it was a nice thing for shareholders. I have to do that. But we also really did it to assimilate the bank in a way that's very safe for the system, and it didn't cost uninsured depositors, didn't cost the FDIC. It cost the FDIC as little as possible. But I also want to point out, I'd be fine if they want to change the rules a little bit to make it easier for a regional bank to buy a big bank. And the other thing about big banks, which again is, I know, but the thing about big banks, we need healthy big banks. We have the best banking system in the world. You know, and you want
You're
that.
You're very big.
Yeah, but we're not. Banks are becoming smaller and smaller as a part of the global system. So when they look at banks, they say, oh, it's big. But when you look at the banking system to the system, mortgages have left, a lot of private credits left, certain trading functions have left, a lot of things are going to leave. You have Apple, you have the neobanks, you better be a little more thoughtful about when you say, when you mean banking per se. Okay. And so.
But the U.S., the Americans should not fear too much finance consolidation in your hands.
No, because, you know, most of our size accrues to our clients. So if you look at, you know, we do most large, small banks can't do, we do like banking large corporations of 50 countries around the world and move $10 trillion a day. They, you know, it's hard. So these are big, complex things. We're not big and complex we want to be. Yeah. We're big and complex because the people we serve are big and complex. We bank countries, the World Bank. You know, we do a lot of things. And yes, we also bank consumers in the United States. So, but I want the community banks to thrive. I mean, like I said, we want to do everything we can to help them. We didn't want this to happen. We didn't cause it to happen. The second it happened, we knew it was bad for all banks.
Are you too big to fail?
I don't know what that word means anymore. I mean, we're not going to fail, and I don't know what that means. But we certainly didn't mean it to be an advantage. Like, So, you know, we've asked all our people when this crisis happened, I don't want anyone soliciting any client or any banker from any of the any right. bank that's, you know, regional bank or community bank, et cetera. So,
is there anything else that you'd be buying? I mean, some of the smaller banks fund.
That's it. No. I mean, we're going to have a lot of blowback on having bought this one, but it was the right thing to do, you know, but we'll get the blowback. But again, my job is this. People at this thing, they always look at, like, the financial deal. Forget the financial deal. 800 people working around the clock. 10,000 people deployed now to consolidate systems, risk, fraud, credit, payments, branches, real estate, vendors, technology. It's a lot of work, you know, and it distracts us from those other things. And so, you know, like I said, we did it. It was marginally beneficial for shareholders. Yeah. It was good for the system, but... and you know, we have to be prepared for the other side of that mountain.
And you've been listening to Jamie Dimon, CEO of JPMorgan Chase, with Bloomberg's Francine Lacqua from the sidelines of the bank's Global Markets Conference in Paris.
And coming up,
the inflation debate continues to rage on ahead of the Fed's June meeting.
And former President Bill Clinton says it is time to do away with the Electoral College. You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, a lot of speculation again this week about how high U.S. inflation can go and what the Fed will do about it.
And Vince Reinhardt, chief economist at Dreyfus and Mellon, says the Fed can't stop it until it is 100% certain it has cured inflation.
Once they stop, once they go a meeting without policy action, everybody is going to assume that the Federal Reserve has drawn a line under this policy firming cycle. And so you better be sure that when you stop, you're not going to look back at regret, you know, just a couple months later. Remember, they slowed a little early in January relative to what, in retrospect, they think they should have done. They're having flashbacks to that right now.
Reinhardt also indicates that because of all this, it's possible the Fed could hike again in June.
And we also had a chance to hear about this from Bill Dudley.
He is a former New York Fed president and currently a Bloomberg Opinion columnist.
And he tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Michael McKee the Fed has to see inflation way lower before he can relax.
I think when the Fed gets the inflation rate down into the twos and there's more slack in the labor market and wages are rising more like 3-4% rather than 5-6%, which they're doing now. You know, the Fed's making some progress on the inflation front, but they haven't made much progress yet on the labor market and on the wage trend. So it's hard to see inflation going all the way back to 2% with a labor market this tight and wages this high.
In your studies at Berkeley, is it necessary to have unemployment go up to bring inflation down? Why can't we just move the inflation needle, the disinflation needle, and keep America employed?
Well, that'd be the ideal outcome. It'd be great if we could operate at a 3.4% unemployment rate with 2% inflation. But historically, that suggests that has not happened in the past. The labor market at that level of tightness generates wage gains that are inconsistent with 2% inflation. And the Federal Reserve doesn't think that's going to happen. The Federal Reserve, if you look at their last summary of economic projections, expects that they're going to need to push the unemployment rate up above 4.5% to be successful in bringing inflation down. So they need to push the unemployment rate by up more than a full percentage point in their minds to be successful. And I think that's a reasonable forecast.
Bill, it's Mike. Switching to that jobs report data, the calculations people are making to get to that 4.5% by the end of the year, which the Fed has forecast, we need to all of a sudden start losing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. Do you see any prospect of that?
Well, I think this just reiterates the tension between what the Fed thinks in terms of how long they're going to have to keep rates high versus what the market thinks. The Fed thinks this is all going to be a very slow process. It's going to take many, many months. And I think when we get the next summary of economic projections from the Fed in June, you'll probably see them being less optimistic about how fast they can bring inflation back down to 2%. They need payroll gains of 50,000 or less to push the unemployment rate up by a meaningful amount. And they haven't gotten anything like that yet.
Are they there in terms of being restrictive enough, or is there anything in the data that you've seen so far since the last meeting that would suggest that maybe they need to do more?
They think they're restrictive enough. And I think one reason why they think they're restrictive enough is we're going to see some credit constraints from the banking sector because of the turmoil we've seen in the banking area. So they're thinking that credit conditions are going to be tighter as banks pull back a bit. One area, though, where you have to be a little bit concerned is the housing sector, which is really the most interest rate sensitive sector of the economy, seems to be bottoming out. So if monetary policy is really tight and the housing market is starting to recover again, then that does raise a question of whether the Fed is sufficiently tight.
Bill Dudley, I want to go to your latest essay. Are you advocating a three-part Fed with a responsibility of inflation dynamics, jobs dynamics, and financial stability dynamics?
Well, I guess the way I would put it is financial stability is a necessary condition for an effective monetary policy. If you don't have financial stability, you lose control of monetary policy. So as part of your monetary policy mandate, you have to have a great close focus on financial stability. And the fact is the Fed missed what was going to happen in the banking sector. If you look back at the November financial stability report, there was nothing about the potential funding risk of regional banks. There was nothing about the large mark-to-market losses on their balance sheet. There was nothing about the risk that uninsured depositors might leave.
Right.
So the Fed really didn't capture that. And I give the Fed a lot of credit for the report that they published just recently on what went wrong with Silicon Valley Bank. I think they do recognize their supervisory failures, but that's not sufficient. Monetary policy also contributed to what happened because the Fed basically made interest rates very low for a very long time. They flooded the banking system with deposits. Some banks took those deposits and bought long-dated assets. That didn't work out for them. So the Fed Reserve's monetary policy did contribute to the problems that we've seen in the banking sector.
When do we get under 3% inflation?
I think we'll probably see it before the end of the year because housing inflation is going to come down pretty dramatically. We've seen that the housing inflation in the CPI and in the PC deflator lags a lot behind what's actually happening in housing. So that's going to start to turn down pretty sharply, right, I think, in the second half of the year. And that will help us on headline inflation.
That was Bill Dudley, former New York Fed president and currently a Bloomberg Opinion columnist with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Michael McKee.
All right, Ed, we're going to shift now from Fed policy to politics and public policy.
And you know how presidential candidates keep winning the popular vote but losing the Electoral College, thus the election?
Yeah, especially Democrats, including Al Gore and Hillary Clinton, if you think of two recent cases.
Mm-hmm. And David Rubenstein caught up with Bill Clinton, and that's one of the things Rubenstein asked the former president about. So check this out.
President Clinton, today, if you were to say we should change the way the presidents are elected, obviously you were elected twice, so you probably are reasonably happy with the method, but do you think direct election of the president, popular vote, would be preferable to the Electoral College method?
I do. I think, first of all, we adopted the Electoral College when we were 13 states, and we had a couple of really big states and some really, really small states that had distinct differences, but it also helped to load up the electoral votes of the southern states that had slaves. And now we know that the effect of the Electoral College is to give about 36 extra votes to the most culturally conservative and furthest right American states. And I have no objection to them voting. I want them all to vote. I would not, unlike some of them, I'd never try to make it harder for them to vote. I'd make it easier for them to vote. I want the votes counted, and I want them all to count, but I just don't think you can justify that today. Now, if you did it, the first question you got to ask yourself is, would we have more three-party or four-party national elections? And if so, would we have to have a runoff? That is, should you at least require a president to have, 40% of the vote, 45% of the vote? Lincoln got elected with like 39%. And I know when Ross Perot got like 19% in 92. So I won the election by, I think, 5.5 points, 5.8 points, something like that. But I only got 43.8% of the vote. So I think we should get rid of it. But you have to think about, what are you going to do if there is no such thing as a perfect system, and it may unleash even more parties. So should there be a minimum?
And that was former President Bill Clinton there with David Rubenstein on The David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations.
And the full interview with former President Clinton and former First Lady, Secretary of State, and presidential candidate Hillary Clinton will air on Peer-to-Peer Conversations this coming fall.
And coming up, former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair says the UK better hurry up and fix the problems Brexit has created, especially for finance and tech.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. Ed, we were just hearing a few minutes ago from former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, right. And we also caught up with former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair.
And he had some strong words for us, Ed, about problems he says Brexit is creating.
So here's Bloomberg's Lizzie Burden now with the former PM. Let's listen in.
So, Tony, thank you very much for making time for us. Labour did well in the local elections last week, but the general election's still a long way off. Keir Starmer's got his poll lead. Does he need to carry the Ming vase to victory, or should he be bolder?
Well, he's done a pretty good job of pulling the Labour Party back from where it was. I mean, remember in 2019, it was just about the worst defeat in the Labour Party's 120-year history. So, you know, we've come back a long way, and he's done an excellent job, I think, of leading the Labour Party. But, of course, you can't be complacent about these things at all. You know, the polls may show him in the lead. The local election results were pretty good, really. Very bad for the Conservatives. But you don't take anything for granted, and I'm sure he won't. And what you'll find, I think, over the next few months is that the Labour Party sets out more of a policy, a detailed policy stall for government.
Is Keir Starmer the natural heir to New Labour, though?
Well, things have moved on, but I think in terms of is he essentially trying to fight from the centre and construct a modern agenda? Yeah, I think he's trying to do that. But, you know, that's always the way that you win, particularly if you're on the centre-left of politics. You've got to have an agenda that brings people together, that gives the country a clear sense of what the future can hold and brings back some optimism. Because right now, people need optimism. I mean, if you think about it, we've got a pretty extraordinary situation where we're taxing heavily, probably as much as we ever have, spending more than we ever have, with poor outcomes in public services. And that's both his political argument, but it's also the burden that he carries, because it's going to be, you know, it's going to be tough. And that's why we've got to focus very much on the things that will really bring back growth short term, and then look at the long term structural reforms that are the things Britain really needs.
Well, the Bank of England's chief economist says that Britons just need to accept they're worse off, do they?
No, I don't think we should ever accept that we need to be worse off. But I think, on the other hand, when people are looking at the figures and saying, well, living standards are falling for a significant number of people, and the cost of living is really tough, there's no point in criticizing them for saying it. I mean, the point is to do something about it. And I think you can divide this very clearly into two separate groups of measures. I think there are short-term things that we need to do, including fixing the Brexit problems, making sure, for example, we reform our planning laws and do that urgently, making sure we deal with the labour market shortages. And then there are some longer term things, structural things, that in my view are all around how you utilise technology, how you harness the forthcoming and existing technology revolution to make change. So you've got a short term and a long term, but both of them need a set of decisions and a plan.
We mentioned about fixing the Brexit problems. JP Morgan's EMEA CEO says Brexit's cannibalised London's listing pool. Of course, Brexit's here to stay. What's the policy change that could make the most of it for the city?
Well, I think trying to make sure that you get some alignment, some acceptance of you know, equivalence in financial services, it's going to be difficult to do. But, you know, the fact is, if we don't deal with some of the problems that have arisen from Brexit, that the damage is continuing, and it's now. And so it's not, you know, I know people don't want to go back into what has been a very divisive debate, but if you look at some of the critical sectors for the UK economy going forward, financial services is one, life sciences is another, the whole technology sector, if you like. You know, at the moment, there are problems being caused by the overhang of the Brexit difficulties. You've got to fix them. Now, my institute published a paper some months ago, literally setting out step by step how you do that. And then you've got to build new pillars of cooperation with Europe around energy, around defence, probably technology regulation, things where it's obvious we've got a lot in common and we'll do better if we work together.
Would you advise your son to list his company in London?
Well, it's his decision. I think he's got people much better qualified to give him financial advice than me. Anyway, I suspect that's some time off.
But it'd be quite a blow for a former Prime Minister's son to not choose to list here in the UK.
Yeah, well, Lizzie, it's not for here and now. However, the serious point is, you know, we're in a position where if we're not careful, we're going to lose altitude even with the City of London, which is all. And I've always said to people, no matter how much people complain about the financial service sector, it's a major part of our economy. We've got to keep it strong. We've got to keep it preeminent. And that means fixing, as I say, some of the consequences of Brexit. And there's no, you know, OK, we know we can't reverse the decision, but it doesn't mean to say that you can't debate and discuss ways of fixing the problem.
And another key stumbling block, of course, post-Brexit has been Northern Ireland. What does Rishi Sunak need to give the DUP to bring them back to power sharing?
Well, I think, you know, my experience of when we would hit roadblocks in the Northern Ireland process is you just need to sit down privately, quietly, you know, not with a great fanfare of publicity and work out a way through. There are a whole set of different elements you can put into a deal, but we need the executive back up and running. And, you know, the trouble is, again, what's happened is that a lot of the bandwidth of government over these past 7 years has been taken up with trying to deal with the aftermath of Brexit. And that's also a problem if it's distracting government the whole time from dealing with, you know, the real problems that would and the problems that would exist irrespective of Brexit. So I think on Northern Ireland, I think I'm sure the Prime Minister will try and find a way through. I think there is one that can be found. And, you know, much as he did with the Northern Ireland Protocol in the end, you've just got to have a pragmatic solution. But we need it fast because we need to get the thing moving. You know, the thing that's one of the biggest problems with Britain at the moment is just the sense that we don't have that strong forward momentum behind a plan for the country's future.
But I mean, to get them round the table, to get them in the room, does it have to be a financial giveaway?
Well, there's lots of different things you can do. And to be absolutely frank, this is not a lot of point in me speculating on it, because when I used to deal with this, it was like a jigsaw with a whole lot of different elements, and you've got to fit them together in a way that makes sense. But I'll leave that to him.
And when Joe Biden was here for the Good Friday and Agreement anniversary, he spent more time in Ireland than he did in the UK. What's gone wrong with the special relationship?
Well, the relationship between the US and the UK is very, very strong. I mean, it's always going to remain strong at an institutional level because our armed services cooperate strongly, our intelligence services cooperate strongly. Look, I think politically, you know, we need to find a way of strengthening the relationship again, because it's important to us. And particularly as the world goes into quite an uncertain geopolitical period with a, you know, this enormous and I suspect growing tension between America and China, it's important that Britain keeps its traditional relationship strong. And, you know, the American relationship obviously is absolutely critical for us.
And you mentioned China. How do you reconcile China's lack of democratic values with its economic power on the world stage?
Well, its economic power derived from the fact that it opened up. You know, the economic power of China came from when they changed policy under Deng Xiaoping, and then they opened up and started to open up the economy. And as a result of that, you know, they had the fastest period of lifting people out of poverty the world has ever seen. And the Chinese economy is a huge economy today, but China, you know, China is a, by reason of its civilization, its population, its technology, and its economy, it's going to be a big world power. The question is how we live with that in a changing geopolitical 21st century. And my view, as I've always said to people, is you've got to be strong enough to deal with whatever comes out of China, but you should stay engaged with China. And so I don't agree with decoupling, and I don't agree with the notion that you treat China like the Soviet Union, because it isn't.
And you've been listening to former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair with Bloomberg's Lizzie Burden.
And coming up,
we stay in the UK with a close-up look at what the coronation of King Charles means for the country going forward.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, royal fans in the UK are still replaying last weekend's events with a coronation and then the celebrations.
And Ed, King Charles III and Queen Camilla, well, they let others take the center stage last Sunday after the main events. The monarchs took in a star-studded concert featuring the likes of Katy Perry, Lionel Richie, and others at Windsor Castle. And the heir to the throne, Prince William, he addressed the crowd at that point.
As my grandmother said when she was crowned, coronations are a declaration of our hopes for the future. And I know she's up there, fondly keeping an eye on us, and she'd be a very proud mother.
And the pomp and ceremony in Britain around the coronation of King Charles also had some detractors.
And now that the dust has settled on the formal events, some of the focus is turning to what's next for the monarchy as a symbol of Britain's soft power.
So Bloomberg's Eileen Bagbo brings us a special report on that from London.
King Charles III was crowned during a weekend of celebrations and some protests in an event watched by millions. With many of the world's leaders present, it was a moment for British soft power, but also of reckoning with the past. Queen Elizabeth II was viewed by many as a personification of the UK's influence on the world stage. Described by some as Britain's greatest diplomatic asset, she met with leaders from across the globe and held a unique position as the head of the Commonwealth. But, with a role built on the legacy of Britain's empire, does her passing signal the end of royal diplomacy and with it a UK edge?
I think there is value in that relationship historically, but of course history also has its complications given what we know about the history of colonialism and empire from the UK. So these issues are not entirely straightforward.
That's Sir Simon James Fraser, a former British diplomat who served as the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office. He says there is a place for the new king in the diplomatic sphere, but the path forward is not without its challenges.
The important thing is for the new king to establish, if you like, his identity as the king of the UK and therefore as the head of the Commonwealth. And that will be very important because, to be absolutely clear, a lot of this in the past was associated with the personality and the personal history of Queen Elizabeth II. So he's got to establish his own position, and that will influence how other people, how other countries, the realms and other members of the Commonwealth think about this relationship in the future.
But his view is far removed from how many around the world see the monarch and the Commonwealth as symbols of the British Empire's darkest moments. Historian Dr. Imabong Imoran is the author of Empire Without End. She says it's hard to separate royalty from the history of empire.
There are many who would say that there really is very little value in the monarchy, given the monarchy's own links directly to slavery, to colonialism, things that have really decimated the Caribbean over centuries. So I think this is also fueling these different attitudes towards the monarchy.
For his part, the new king has shown remorse for Britain's role in the slave trade, signalling his support for research into the royal family's links to it.
I cannot describe the depths of my personal sorrow at the suffering of so many, as I continue to deepen my own understanding of slavery's enduring impact.
Perhaps King Charles's recent success in Germany is a taste of what is to come. Widely praised for his Bundestag speech, partly in fluent German, and diplomatic outreach post-Brexit.
Danke, danke ich Ihnen von ganzem Herzen für die außerordentliche Anteilnahme der Menschen in Deutschland.
So, there are positive signs. But with referendums on the monarchy's role planned in the Commonwealth nations, including Antigua and the Bahamas, King Charles will need to offer more of this careful diplomacy to cement the new Carolean era. In London, I'm Eileen Bagbo, Bloomberg Radio.
Great piece there from Eileen Bagbo as we continue to get insight from our reporters all around the world here on Bloomberg Radio.
And that is it for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg, and stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.